Dennis, our IT expert, is doing all that work for us. We have upcoming meetings on June 22nd, which will feature attorney Julie Swain doing a discussion on substance abuse, which you'll be able to earn ethics MCLE credits. And then on July 27th, we will have the summer soiree. If anybody is interested in joining NAPA, we're going to be having elections coming up. We are taking nominations. If there's anybody that you would like to nominate to be on the board of directors and then potentially be an officer, please jot down their name or let one of the officers or somebody see. Now it is my pleasure to introduce to you our guest speaker for the evening. All of you know who he is. He's Marlon Stapleton. His facts rely upon his 40 years. Does not look like he's been practicing 40 years. 40 years of criminal defense trial experience, handling cases ranging from misdemeanor offenses to the most serious, sophisticated, and complex felonies in Southern California. The experience includes not only being selected by the Orange County Superior Court judges to the homicide panel for 30 plus years, but also being one of an elite few private attorneys qualified and selected to be a lead counsel representing defendants charged with capital murder, death penalty prosecution. Mr. Stapleton's clients know they can depend on a well-prepared and organized defense presented by one of Orange County's most skilled criminal defense trial attorneys. His clients include many professionals, attorneys, firemen, police officers, doctors. Mr. Stapleton is recognized throughout the Orange County legal community and certainly within the Northern Orange County legal community as one of the top criminal defense attorneys and one of the top criminal defense trial attorneys. He's also rated AB preeminent through Martin Hall. Can we please have a warm welcome for Marlon Stapleton? Good evening, everybody.
Good evening.
We can get some free food, some beer, and some wine.
A little bit of knowledge, hopefully.
There you are.
Thanks for having me.
Not bad for the
first appreciate
time.
The introduction, Mike. That was very nice. So let's start out by, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not used to the microphone. I'm way too loud for the microphone. You know how that is, Dan.
Yeah.
I like to talk about being a trial attorney, right? When I was a young kid and I was going to be a police officer at first, and I decided school seemed to get easier after high school. I hated school in high school, and then it seemed to get a lot easier. So I decided to go to law school, and when I got out of law school, I wanted to be a trial attorney. And everybody in this room is a trial attorney, and some people that we hear talk all the time say they're trial attorneys, right? We hear these big parties we go to, and everybody's a trial attorney, right? But we know that's not exactly true. But that was my goal when I decided to become a lawyer. If I was going to be a lawyer, I wanted to be a criminal defense lawyer, and I wanted to be a trial attorney. I never went the road of the DA's office or the public defender's office. I think one of the very few, maybe one or two people who started my career in private practice. My father was an attorney. At the time I became an attorney, he was a family law attorney. But he had done quite a bit of criminal defense, including homicides. So I had a mentor out of the gate, but I just wanted to be a trial attorney, and I wanted to be a damn good one. I don't know why. Being a trial attorney is very similar to being in sports, if any of you make that connection. It's very competitive. And if you were competitive as a young kid and you wanted to be good at something and you wanted to win, being a trial attorney is all of that. But, you know, they don't make television shows about settling civil cases and do. They make it about trials, criminal trials. So that's where I wanted to start. And it's a great career. We're going to talk a little bit tonight about professionalism at the end of all this, because it's something that's deteriorated, I've noticed, and so have a lot of judges, and I've got a lot of feedback from judges because I've given talks about professionalism. And bringing professionalism back to the attorney. Hey, when I started as an attorney, it was 1983, and there were no cell phones. It was illegal to advertise. That means even in the Yellow Pages, you couldn't have a Yellow Page ad. And being an attorney, I grew up with all these judges that some of you would never remember their names, or some of the mean old judges like Judge Murray, Judge Ripples, these guys that were just, being an attorney meant something, even back then. And it's deteriorated a little bit, but I think it's our responsibility to try to bring a lot of that back, everybody. Because you can, and you can be an unbelievably awesome attorney and still be really professional. So let's get started a little bit. So the client comes in, right? So a client, you get a client, and client comes in and they hire you, sign your retainer agreement, they hopefully pay you. And I'm going to focus probably more towards the felony side, but all this stuff applies to everything. Client hires you, and the first thing you need to do, and I just put up my little easy to read notes outline. The first thing you need to do, believe it or not, is you need to prep your file and need it organized, right? You get all your discovery. And nowadays, be careful what you ask for. With the litigation we've had about discovery, and now we get thousands of pages of useless discovery, and you have to sift through it. But you need to organize all that stuff. And I had some great mentors growing up in this business, guys like George Peters, Jim Stotler, things like that, when they were doing criminal defense. And believe it or not, organization is 50% or more of any sophisticated trial or even your minor trials. If you're organized, you're way ahead of the game. I can't tell you, even I've done death penalty cases, and I won't name names or anything, but I've done death penalty cases where guys walk in with a giant file of paperwork and stuff sticking out of their file, and it's just not a good situation. You'd be surprised. And so you really want to start out being organized, especially on complex cases, which is pretty much my focus now. I don't try most of my lesser trials now. I hand off to my great associate, Scott Henry. And but you really need, and he knows this too, you've got to be organized, which means if it's a bigger case, you need to start out with notebooks, right? And this may be, for some of you, it may be like, oh, well, yeah, we know that. But I'm going to show you a few things that I hope helps about organization and how to index notebooks and things like that. If you want to take your discovery, you just take it now. It's base number. In the old days, it's ever number. You just got miles of discovery. And you just start putting it in a notebook, and you have your assistant. Hopefully, if you have an assistant, not you do. You sit down and you number all the different reports, and then you start with an index, okay? Indexes are very simple. People have different, I've seen everybody. I'm not technically savvy. So it's a simple index,
But this is how I index cases. And I index them by tab number, by date of the report, by the author, which is important because then you can just, when you're sitting at a prelim or you're sitting at something, the DA calls a case, you don't know exactly that officer, you can just whip down through all the officers, you can find that number, that top, and look and see if that's the report you're looking for. The thing that I do a lot, my indexes, and you know, the procedures that I'm going to talk to you guys about these indexes, and you go, that's normal, everybody indexes that. But then when you index, you need to really make notes as you do your indexes and put them in, highlight your indexes, put handwritten notes in there. All these things do is make you super familiar with your case. And it makes you much more organized than the guy sitting next to you, because they don't have the time to do all that stuff. So you can see I put down the author, and then I put down the description of what it is. And finally, the bait stamp box. But in that box is the box where I put a lot of notes. And I'll just put notes that I think are really important pieces. So if they call that witness, I'm going to get into your trial holder in a minute, but if they call that witness, I can go really quick and say, oh, so there's the guy that heard the shots, saw the victim of the gun, and like this last one, I'm going to... This one, the first note, you can see it says, saw guy with the victim picking up shell cases. My defense in this case was self-defense, where the victim was actually shooting at my client. So that's obviously very strong proof that the victim was shooting at my client. If his buddy was, while he's dead in the street, picking up all the shell cases to hide it before he leaves. So index your files. It's simple to do, especially if you have a good assistant. And then make notes in. As you work the case, make your notes so you can reference them really quick. Okay. So next, I'll tell you is trial folders. Now, all you guys probably know about this, these are, what I do is when I get ready to start a trial, the first thing my secretary does is she makes a trial folder for me. And in that trial folder, it's an expandable file. There are multiple manila files. And in each one of those files, there's things like charging document file. So when I'm in trial, if the CA or the judge wants to reference something, I can go and go right to each one of those files. Or as trial progresses, I can put all of that, I can put all of those things in each one of the files. So as the trial goes, you're not fumbling. If you're not organized at the start of the trial, I promise you, you will be much less organized at the end of the trial. So these are some of the folders that I put in there. I think they cover just about everything.
Hey, Mike.
So, Mike. First, a charging document folder.
You're upside down.
All right, let's get turned back on.
Okay. So, witness list. The DA will give you a witness list. You have a witness list. Put it in another folder. 402s. Talk about 402s. I'm not a super big appellate lawyer, guys. I'm a trial lawyer. But even in a trial lawyer, you got to do 20 of 402s.
You turned it off.
Most of those 402s that I've found nowadays, besides but really not important evidentiary fights, are bifurcations. With all the new laws, you can bifurcate just about everything. The last trial I just finished in February, in March, it was about 5 weeks long, was a homicide. You could have bifurcated the gang stuff. You could have bifurcated. I even bifurcated all the new aggravating factors that the DAs are now alleging. Bifurcate the priors. If you can get your trial as clean as possible, where the jury doesn't have to hear all these other issues other than the guilt or innocence of your client, you're going to be a lot better off. So try to bifurcate those issues. In gang cases, it's difficult many times to bifurcate the gang allegations because it's the central issue in the case. And a lot of times you're arguing self-defense based on a lot of the gang culture evidence that comes in and how they would have reacted to your client and they would have attacked your client. So you have to weigh all those things, but bifurcation, things like being biased, you want to make sure you get rid of the prior convictions if your client has any. I'm not going to go too deep into any subjects here because it's, you could do complete seminars on just about every one of these headings. Jury selection. There's a file for jury selection. All your voir dire notes, which are really important nowadays, 237.1. Opening statement. Your opening statement notes. Exhibit lists. Photos. Any photos that you plan on using in your trial, take them out ahead of time. Put them in a folder. Put them in order that you think you'll use them. Defense investigation, if you have investigation reports. This is a big one. In every trial, I don't know about you guys, every single trial I do, I get tons of discovery and notes and just all kinds of documents from the DA during the trial. So I put it in the recent discovery / late discovery file. As a technology monocle. Stipulations, if you're entering into stipulations, I'll tell you just briefly, there's nothing wrong with stipulations if you can do them. Don't overstipulate your case, but if you can clean up your case by stipulating the things and it's going to help you, do it. So that's another file. Jury instructions, closing argument, and verdict forms. If you make an expando file and put all those in there, by the time you're done with your trial, I promise you every one of those manila files is going to be full. And you'll have a huge, thick, expandable file. Okay, so now we're at, I say bring them in. That's what you hear every judge says to the bailiff. Bring them in. It's the time when they bring all the jurors in. And, you know, my dad taught me when I was first a lawyer, there's no lonelier time in the world in this business as when all those jurors come in and they see you sitting there with your client who has death squad tattooed on his face and a swastika on his face. And the judge reads the information to the jury and everyone in that courtroom, and the only people on your side is your client sitting next to you. And there is no tougher job in the world than to take that moment and try to turn it around to where the jury likes you somewhat, to where the jury has, you have credibility with the jury, and where the jury trusts you. You go from that moment, reading that your client has killed someone, that he's charged with the death penalty, that, or he has molested numerous children, just horrible things, the jury is gonna hate you at first. And there's no tougher job than to try to make that jury like you, try to make that jury respect you, have credibility and trust with that jury. And at the end, when you do closing arguments, you'll know it. Because your jurors will look at you, they'll shake their heads up and down, and you can tell they're listening to you. If you didn't pass that test, the jury sit with their head turned sideways and won't even pay attention to what you're saying. So it's super important. It's your individual duty to do it. You have to figure out how to do it, but it's really important to talk to jurors and don't make arguments or make statements to jurors that are ridiculous. I've seen lawyers argue things that are ridiculous. You make one argument to a jury, one statement to a jury, one example to a jury in jury selection that they think is stupid, you're done. Your client's done. That's how gradual this is. So you have to be really professional, really nice. One of the things I really like to do, let's just move right into jury selection. One of the things, and Scott will tell you this because he just sat in on a homicide that I did. One of the things I always do to jurors when I get called up is, the first thing I do is I'll leave where I'm talking and I'll walk right up to them and I'll say, good morning or good afternoon. And you know what? If you do it with sincerity,
they will respond right back to you. A lot of them will do it.
And it's a really important thing to do to make them know that you're serious and you respect them. But don't be afraid to do it. The guy who was really good at doing it, believe it or not, was Brahim. Brahim was really good at doing it. And it's something that's a big deal. So jury selection, I'm going to talk about it. I've done a full seminar to NACFA and the Orange County Bar Association on jury selection. I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I'm going to do some new, there's some new stuff about jury selection. It's really important to everyone and the judges. And we have a huge advantage in jury selection as a defense. Even before 237.1, huge, huge advantage. D is always, everyone thought we had a disadvantage, but the reason we have a huge advantage is we don't have to pick a perfect jury, right? So I used to use a program called My Jury. I got rid of it. It was really fun. But we don't have to pick a perfect jury that DA does. The DA gets one bad jury, they could be in trouble. I'm not the guy like the DA's will get up and go, he just wants one jury, one pretty mistake on it. One jury, I'm not that guy. I don't want one jury. I want all. I want everybody. But just they have to pick a perfect jury, you don't. So if you get five or six really good jurors that you like on the panel, don't take a nut ball. But if you get five or six really good jurors that are on that panel, and you have a couple that are not too good, some that you just want to get rid of, start passing. Because what will happen is, in my experience, when I started doing this years ago, I got way ahead of the DA. Where in our experience, a lot of guys I see, they get way behind the DA. It's not so much now with 237.1, but just remember, if you get a pretty, what is it? Perfection is the enemy of good enough, right? That's a great statement. When you're picking a jury, remember that. Don't try to pick a perfect jury. That's the DA's job. I gave you guys a handout. I promise you, this handout, it will get you through any jury selection as a defense lawyer. Sorry, guys. But it will get you through any jury selection. And I'm not going to go over it one by one. If you guys have questions about some of the notes I have in it, later, call me. I'll be glad to go through it with you. But I promise you, it will get you through any jury selection and you'll work like a star. It works really good. It covers everything. And you will know who the people you want to kick off by the end of the jury selection, just with those questions. So questionnaires, I use them in big cases sometimes. Some of the judges are starting to use them more and more now because it's 237.1. They'll have little short, 4 to 6 questionnaires. Judge Menninger had four or six question questionnaire, and it talked about some of the major issues in her case. They'll let you do it. Board iron nowadays is getting better for us. It's the judges are starting to give us more time because of the 237.1 issues and things like that. So let's talk about that. Some of you may be going, what's 237.1? If you haven't heard about 237.1, I would be surprised. Okay. So 237.1 is the codification of Batson and Wheeler. They are race-based strikes, preemptive strikes, right? Preemptory strikes. The DAs are absolutely losing their minds about it. They're totally afraid of it. I haven't seen it because I had that homicide with Janine that I just finished, Janine Madera, and Janine and I just picked our regular jury pretty much. But I, believe it or not, and Scott will laugh and tell you guys a story about this if you ask him. I got 237.1 by Judge Menninger. He actually, on a court's own motion, took me into chambers because I had kicked my 9th Asian juror. And I kicked, or 8th. 8th or 9th?
Yeah.
8th. 7th. 7th and 8th. She kicked me. Okay, so she warned me on the 7th, and I didn't really care because I was kicking him for good reasons. And she warned me on it, and I kicked the 8th, and I knew it. And she said, okay, we're going to go meet Chambers before she excused the jury. And just let me read it to you real quick. A party shall not use a peremptory challenge to renew a prospective juror on the basis of prospective juror's race, ethnicity, gender identity, sexual orientation, national origin, religious affiliation, or the perceived membership of the prospective juror in any of those groups. Okay? So here's the, so manager takes me back in the back. And everybody's like, oh, uh-oh. And I was laughing. I literally was laughing. I put my arms up on the chair and I said, Judge, what are you doing? She's like, well, Mr. Fagan, I have a duty to protect the record. When it comes to this, I said, no record. There's no record. We use numbers in gang homicides. All those jurors are being referred to by numbers. She's like, yeah, but if somebody looks back, they'll find this. And I said, Judge, this is going to come to a shock to you, but 237.1 in practical application does not apply to the defense. And she's like, oh, yes, it does. And I said, how? First of all, no post-conviction lawyer, which is all the scary guys in San Francisco who attack us trial lawyers for being ineffective. Yeah, Crawford. And I said, Judge, what in this world, when is a post-conviction, you can tell me if I'm right or not, Jen, who is going to attack me and call me ineffective because I kicked a juror who was terrible for my client? No one's going to. But I promise you, they're going to attack you if you leave that crappy juror on. And
yeah,
she,
right.
And the light bulb went on in her head, and she's like, oh. Well, I've got she you can see it come on, and we've had discussions afterward that I'm right. It doesn't really apply to us because we're not going to get overturned for it. And you know what? In my 40 years of doing this, and almost like somewhere between 250 and 300 trials, I have never kicked a juror based on what they look like. I kick the jurors because they suck for my client. They're terrible, no matter what color they are. You can hear the answers coming out. You know, I strip every single lawyer I know that does defense work, gets rid of jurors because that juror is likely not to pay attention or listen to the defense attorney and isn't going to be fair when it comes to making a decision on whether to find your client guilty or not guilty. Strictly, that's the only criteria that we care about as criminal defense lawyers. Now, DAs may have different motivations. But that law was passed because of DAs, not because of defense attorneys. So I laugh because I don't think it has any teeth for us. And I don't think it really applies in practical application to us. So so if anybody ever talks to you about it, tell them what you think. You know, you'll get it through your own experience. But oh, by the way, manager did make me go through every strike. She did go ahead and make me protect the record for her. And the first juror that was still sitting out there that she refused to strike, her husband was LAPD. The second juror started crying when he talked about his best friend was murdered 20 years ago. And the third juror, I had asked to excuse the cause and she denied it. So that's how bad all those jurors were. But it's, she did make me do it, but then she made a record that said, I justified every strike and met my burden and that was the end. So, don't be too worried about 237.1, but I have heard that DAs, a lot of them are hardly striking any, if any, groups. Some of them are accepting. So what's up next? Opening statements. Probably the easiest. The easiest for everyone because the hardest decision about making an opening statement is deciding whether to make one or not. If you have it,
is it 231.7?
It's 231.7. Yeah, 231.7. And so, opening statements, the hard part of this, whether you should give one or not. If you have a good defense, absolutely give one. But make it concise and make it simple and don't be too specific because it'll come back to bite you in the ass. If you make it too, just like DAs, they get too specific and too carried away sometimes. Just tell them what your defense is. Tell them why your client's not, why you're going to have to find my client not guilty after they hear all the evidence. It's that simple. I think lawyers get really caught up and having to talk a lot. Most opening statements, I've given opening statements the longest one I think I've ever given, probably a half hour long, it was in a death penalty case. The closing arguments lasted 2 days each. So, but the opening statements, and warn the jury ahead of time. It's just a roadmap. These trials are fluid, they're dynamic. You never know what's going to happen a lot of times, and things don't always work out the way you're going to say them. So, just make it simple. People are simple speakers, right? That's the standard. Prep and cross exam. So this is the front, but this is probably the most crucial part of your case. And I create another expander file, the kind of reddish color expanding files, and I put vanilla envelopes in each for each and every important witness in the case, and I label them with the witness's name on it, and I make copies of every single thing that witness has said, transcripts, everything, and they go in each file that witness. When I'm prepping, especially some of the big witnesses, there's always, you know who they are, there's always a certain number of really, really important witnesses in a trial. And when it comes to those witnesses, some of them may have 3 or 4 transcripts, lengthy transcripts. What I do is I take a notepad. After I have their files put together, I take a notepad and I draw a line down the center. I put everything that I want to make sure to get out of that witness when he's done testifying. I want to make sure I hit every single point. And next to that, in the other side of the, on the other side of the paper, I put the discovery or the transcript.
He goes in and out all the time when he posts the microphone over here.
Those witnesses usually go sideways on most important parts.
I have
so always put the transcript. Line number and the page number of the transcript or the police report number or where in the police report I can find each one of them. The thing that I have seen so many times by both DAs and defense attorneys is I can't tell you how many times I've seen them trying to impeach witnesses and they'll try to refer them to the transcript or try to find it and they'll keep flipping and flipping and say, you're only going to have a moment. And the more that they flip, the less they're thinking about what they're looking for and the more they're thinking about what the jury's looking at them, wondering why they can't find what they're looking for. And then ultimately they say, oh, I'll get back to that. And they never do. I see it all the time. They never get back to it. They'll miss huge points. So super important. Be organized for your most important witnesses and every single thing that you want to get out of that witness available to impeach that witness with. So that means transcripts, reports, whatever it is, photographs, have them ready for that witness and have them all in separate file folders in an expanded file. Now I say be prepared to impeach and know how. I have seen numerous lawyers that don't know how to impeach a witness. And no, maybe you guys said to me, oh, yeah, I don't think so. I've seen guys in homicides that did not know how to impeach a witness. It's not hard. The witness said something on the witness stand. You ask them, so you're telling this jury and this court that you said A, B, and C. Isn't it true on this date you said C, D, and E, or D, E, and F? And the witness goes, they'll obviously say, I don't remember. And then all you got to do, write to the transcript, have it in your notes, okay? That's line, page 6, line 18 of the transcript, prelim transcript. You said this. Write up to the witness, ask for approach, and you say, so read that to yourself, and then I'm gonna ask you another question. So they read it to themselves, walk away as they say, I'm done, but then you say, Okay, so isn't it true on such and such a date at the preliminary hearing, you said D, E, and F? Most of the time, some of the witnesses will say, yeah, I guess I did, or they'll say, I don't remember. And you just move on to the next one. If you do that so many times and you keep saying, I don't remember every time you approach it, after the court ruling that they're finding that that's being inconsistent, so you don't have to approach him every time, you just ask him, and if he says he doesn't remember, you just move on to the next one. It's really that simple. You don't have to make a big giant theatrical thing out of it or anything. You just want to get it out that he's saying he doesn't remember or he didn't say it, so you can then call the police officer who interviewed him to tell the jury what he said. You would be shocked how many lawyers don't know how to do it. I've seen guys on homicides that didn't know. They just try to all of a sudden read the transcript. They'll just say, oh, and then the judge, everybody at Jackson, they can't get around it, but it's simple. So if you have questions about how to do that, talk to me, just call me, but it's simple. Know how to impeach them and be prepared. And once you get out what you want to get out from that witness, once the inconsistency is established, or once your point is established, move on. Leave it. God, I can't tell you how many people I want as a wife say it. Or they'll try to make him say it again or let him clarify it. They'll ask again. And then this time the guy tries to clarify it. Once you get it out, everything that you're doing during the trial, every single thing you're doing during the trial is so you can avoid it. Once you get it out, leave it alone. Don't let anybody see it until it comes out in your closing argument. Otherwise, you're giving them all this. You're giving them every time you ask that question again, it gives the guy a chance to give a different answer or explain the first answer that he gave. Just move on and leave it alone. Defense witnesses, character witnesses are the most underused tool that we have, and one of the best witnesses you can call, because the DA is able to say anyway. Obviously, it depends on your client's background and the issues of the case, but it's by far the most underutilized evidence that we get. There was a jury instruction that specifically says that a jury can find a defendant not guilty based on character evidence alone, nothing else. That's how important character evidence is if you have a good defendant. So in a gang case, my favorite thing to do on gang cases, which I don't know how many of them, 25 or so, is if I have a good defendant and he's really not a gang member, I will bring in notebooks full of pictures of that defendant with his family at picnics, at fishing trips, at soccer games, at skiing events, everything. The DA goes crazy. That's not relevant. I'm like, what? You can bring in pictures of my client holding a gun and hanging out with his homeboys, and I can't bring out pictures of him hanging out with his family and not being a gang member? Never had a judge in my life. Totally relevant because the TAs always make arguments that the gang is that kid's life. If it's not his life, you can prove it. Great way to do it. So don't overlook character evidence, you guys. It's huge. I know I've run lots of trials just based on obviously facts, but then calling character evidence. You know, the most the judge is going to let you do is about 7, 8, you're not going to usually claim to 10. But just pick your best one. Your clients will try to bring 20, you got to tell them, give me the very best 10, and then talk to the judge about how many they're going to let you do. Very difficult. The next decision is probably the most difficult decision in any trial, whether you're defendant or testifying. A lot of my clients can't testify. It's not possible. Right? If you have a gang member, you can't testify. Not only just because sometimes it's not even his background, it's just that he won't do it because his homeboy is old.
he'll have problems if he gets convicted. And they just moved us along. But it's a really difficult decision. A lot of your good clients are just regular citizens that are in a lot of trouble. You've got to prep them, but you've got to know your client most of all. You have to have a lot of meetings with your client during the time you're trying in this case. And you have to get to know them. Some of our clients are great, and you know immediately they're going to make great witnesses. Some of them are weirdos. Like, they're weird. They're just weird. Like, they may be nice people, but they come across as really weird. And the jurors are not going to like them. And you have to take that into consideration. It sounds terrible, but I tell my clients all the time, hey, I cannot advise you whether you should plead guilty or not based on whether you're innocent. I said, I have to advise you on whether you should take a deal. And what a jury, everything comes down to in this business, what is likely to happen before a jury? You can have the most innocent client in the world, but he looks the guiltiest there is, and the facts make him look guilty. They're going to find him guilty. So if you want to give your clients good advice, you have to be upfront with them and tell them that. So that's what I mean about really getting to know your client. Know your client. He's one of these super aggressive, argumentative guys. It may be in self-defense cases and stuff. You have to let him test it. I had a case one time with Sheila Hansen in front of Tony Verkakis, the judge. And it was a 245 with GBI where my client broke his girlfriend's brother's dog. And I put him on, he was one of those guys that you worried about, and Sheila just got him so mad that Tony leaned over several times during the trial and told him to shut up basically when he was testifying. I took him outside and said, he came across so aggressive, so that they still won. Because it was still a legitimate self-defense. They only punched the guy one time. I thought he lost because of his testimony. So everybody in here, if you've all tried cases, even on deuces, where your client testifies a lot of times, how many times have you tried it? The case was really, really good. So it's a tough decision. You got to make it sometimes. And ultimately, in the big cases, the judges absolutely will get a waiver. Every judge gets waivers from the client. So the client has to agree to it. If you say that the client won't decide he's not going to testify, the judge will do a very thorough waiver of your client saying, you sure have an absolute right to testify. If you don't, that's it. And so the client, if you have an uncooperative client, probably going to testify. Closing arguments. I'm old school. Like, I know Judge Ferguson put together this flyer about Shakespeare and all this great stuff. And I'll tell you something right now. If you guys want to see the best lawyer show on earth, I'll get hooked on it. It has all that Shakespeare and all that stuff. You gotta go and you gotta watch Rumpole. It's an English show about English law. He's an old English trial barrister. He's the greatest lawyer show on earth. It's a series. I think Amazon has it now. You can see clips from them on YouTube, but that's more the flyer that you guys got. That's not me. I'm old school. I don't use PowerPoint. I have a graphic artist who I literally can submit my closing arguments to at midnight. The judge doesn't give us another day. Usually on the bigger cases, they'll give you a couple days to get arguments. But at midnight, and she'll have it done for me by 6 in the morning. She'll work all night on it. This is what they look like. This is a real simple case I did, which is a 245. Those boards, it doesn't look that impressive there because it's a little thing. They're actually 4 foot tall, 3 foot wide, and you put them up on an easel. And this was a 245 where my client, it was at a party, and some guy sat on his face while he was sleeping on a little love seat. Almost broke his neck. My client got up and broke his jaw and broke his over bone and beat him up really bad. But these boards, if you don't use, I mean, obviously a lot of you guys are younger and are really tech savvy, use PowerPoint. I like these boards a lot better than PowerPoint because PowerPoint just gives each slide only has a little bit of information. These have a lot of information, and you put them up on babies when they sit really high in the courtroom. And the jurors will look at them, and they'll just kind of follow with you, but they'll also look ahead, and it stays up there for a while. And it's really more powerful than PowerPoint. I'm fortunate enough to have this gal that I've had at least 30 years. And she's fantastic. But this is how I have closing arguments. Howard said, he was in a bind one time, the judge told me home at lunchtime. I gave him an outline of the closing argument, but he didn't sound like he was going to win. I mean, it's an easy outline for simple cases. The first thing I tell them is, I tell the jury, and I'm really sincere about this, I try to make the jury understand from the first second I see that this trial is not about the defendant. It's about the system. Yes, it's named versus Dale Roy, but it's about upholding the system and jury selection. I'll tell them. I'll talk to them about the system. I'll give them examples. And I won't go through all of them in my jury selection, but I'll give them examples about, I used to ask jurors, what's worse? An innocent man who's being convicted or a guilty man going free. And take the worst case you can think of in your mind, child murder. What's worse? Guilty guy going free, innocent man being convicted. And I always tell them I used to ask that question. Does that seem to get less objections from the kid? So I've never been objected. And I'll tell the jury, it's more a story than it is a question. I'll tell the jury, almost always you'll get one super conservative looking older gentleman, usually a white guy, and he'll say, oh, it's way worse than that. Child molesting, killing, passing, post-proof. It's way worse. And all you have to do is ask one question that changes. What if that innocent person were you? What if that innocent person were your son? And it instantly puts them into understanding that it's about the system and following the law so that the system works so that we don't have this. It's way worse if the innocent guys can do it. Way worse if you look at it individually. And if you get the juror to start understanding that from jury selection, they come with you and they'll do it all the way through the trial. They'll do it. And this is how I always start my closing argument because I work them into that whole way. My closing argument, I said, why are we here? And who's we? The victims, the defendant, we the people. That's what the DA always says, right? The people. Us. Well, we're here to uphold the law. To ensure that the system of justice works for everybody. Goes back to that whole thing with the innocent person. And then what I do is I explain to them the most important jury instructions, which is beyond a reasonable doubt, circumstantial evidence, a reasonable interpretation, and in this particular case, it was the right of self-defense. Self-defense is something that you guys will see. It's like one of the biggest defenses we have. It's by far the funnest defense to put on. I consider myself an expert on self-defense. I tried, at one point in time, there was a 10-year period where I tried probably 245 of GBIs. I won every single one. It was self-defense. Everyone, never lost one. The first self-defense case I ever lost was like a year ago. And that was the guy who also did the three count attempt murder 3 days later in another shooting. So it's the funnest. And the crazy part about self-defense is it's all about reasonable, right? And so you always want to make sure the jury understands two things in self-defense. One is that as long as the defendant's belief was reasonable, as long as it was reasonable, the danger doesn't even have to be real. Okay, period. And another thing I see lawyers not understand, I've had experienced lawyers that didn't understand. The prosecution has the burden of proof to prove the crime was not committed in self-defense. Everyone thinks self-defense means the defense has to put that on. It's the DA's burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, to show it wasn't self-defense. So when you go to that, the jury instructions are phenomenal for us on self-defense. Let me go back to the end. This was one of those 20-45 guys, too, by the way. I actually had one client who had five arrests and filings for 245 with GBI, all in succession, and one of those had an attempt murder to it, too. Every one of those cases was a self-defense case, one, every single one of them. Two of them from Mark Kelly. So at the end of self-defense, to kind of finish off this, is something called, I tell jurors, called the reasonable, Jack really actually taught me. I'm not going to take credit. Jack is one of, I think, the most finest, underrated, underknown trial attorneys there is. The guy is a superstar in the capital defense world and the psychological defense world. But Jack and I talked about this many, many years ago. It's called the reasonable continuum. When you're talking to jurors about self-defense, everything deals with reasonableness. What I tell jurors is you cannot sit in a beautiful, comfortable, quiet courtroom and make decisions easily about if your client acted reasonably. You have to put yourself in that state, in that position, but it's impossible to armchair quarterback a situation that happens in seconds and your well-being is at stake in those seconds. And what I tell them is everyone, you have to reach down deep inside, almost done, and you have to really honestly evaluate how you would have acted in that situation as a person. And I tell them about the 1982 Potomac River air disaster. Some of you may remember it, some of you don't. There was a jet, and I forget what airline, skidded off the runway in Dulles International Airport in Delaware, and went into the river. It was ice floating, freezing cold. It was all on TV. There was a lady there who was trying for her life to grab this helicopter rope. And she was so frozen that she kept getting pulled up and then falling off the rope and going back into the river. There was probably 200 people lining those banks, just praying and watching a TV and stuff that saved this lady. If you ask every one of those 200 people that were standing on that bank the day before, you ask them about a scenario that was similar to that. Every person would have said they would have jumped in. As a reasonable person, they would have jumped in and said, everyone would have said, that's how most people think. That's how I would have acted. I would have jumped in. But in reality, only one person jumped in. Lenny Skupnik. Let's see. So you can always say, oh, I'm going to act a certain way. I would have punched that guy in the face. I would have busted that fool if you were that nasty. I wouldn't do these things. But if you put it in perspective and you use an example that's similar to that and talk about armchair quarterback and how peaceful it is in the courtroom, then you can't possibly understand what your client was going to do. It's super successful. So hopefully some of these tips help you guys. If you have any questions later, you want to come or just give me a call. I had some great mentors growing up. I'm always open to help people if they need help or they have questions on how they might address something. Give me a call.
Thank you, Marlon. That was, of course, very interesting. And we very much appreciate you taking the time to share all your experience and knowledge over the years. I would just like to remind everybody before we close up for the night, our next meeting is June 22nd. Again, that will be Julie Swain giving a discussion on substance abuse. You will be able to see Ethics MCL for that. Lord is holding up something in the back. Does anybody want a kitten?
Does anybody need a kitten?
Right there. Did I give you one? I'm sorry.
If anyone wants to nominate someone for director, by not call, let us know or write down on a piece of paper.
You need a kit.
From you, you can let us know.
Not a sex kit. A real meow.
Good night.
Looks like he's got three right here.